Hello again, welcome to another Media Talk. Coming up this week,
if you've got any comments on the recent announcement of the BBC's proposed closure to Six Music, or indeed on any part of the BBC strategy review, here's the place you should go. That's bbc.co.uk/bbctrust/consultations.
Six Music is the headline casualty as Director General Mark Thompson unveils his big plan for a new BBC. We analyse the DG's strategy to do fewer things better. Also in the podcast,
we will see something we've never seen in this country before. And if they get it right, it'll turn an election. If they don't, it'll bore the country to death. But that will be their fault. They've got the chance now.
BBC political editor Nick Robinson gives us his reaction as the leaders' TV debates finally get the go-ahead. Plus, ITV returns to profit, just, but don't get your cigars and champagne out yet. And Rod Little's out of the running, but is Greg Dyke about to be appointed the next editor of The Independent? This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, it's been a bad week for lovers of new music, so it is with delicious irony that we've been booted out of our regular roomy studio so that the obscure indie band Broken Bones can record a session for our Music Weekly podcast. This is where obviously new bands will have to come to get their big break now that Six Music is closed.
But they've just got a plug on the podcast. They're doing okay.
This is Paul Robinson. He's a broadcasting consultant and managing director of Kidsco TV. How are you, Paul?
I'm good, thanks, yeah.
Good. And Maggie Brown is a Media Guardian columnist. Have you been hobnobbing with the stars this week, Maggie?
I've been hobnobbing with Tim Davey, actually. Just had lunch with him, off the record, of course.
Off the record, of course.
We should say he's the head of BBC Radio and Audio.
Well, I'll ask you for tidbits from that lunch later. There's only one place to start, though, this week, without further ado. So let's head to Lauren Laverne's show on Six Music.
Supergrass and moving on Six Music. It's 10:30. Still ahead today, we're going to be catching up with Tongue. They're in session after 11 o'clock. We've also got cracking tunes on the way from the likes of, Gorillaz, of course, our album of the day, plus playing that record out in its entirety across the station today. We've got music from The Divine Comedy, The Tallest Man on Earth and Funkadelic. I think we better get to the news.
Six Music. BBC News at 10:30, I'm Julian Vicari. The Director-General of the BBC, Mark Thompson, has announced that Six Music is to be axed as part of a new funding strategy. Speaking to staff in the past hour, he said the station was too expensive to run given the size of its audience.
Six Music.
Very sad news, indeed. Director-General Mark Thompson, as you heard, has revealed plans to axe two digital stations and slash half of the BBC's web output in a series of reprioritising measures, I think they're called, the largest in the corporation's history. Other cutbacks include spending 20% less on imported shows, capping investment on sports rights, and potentially selling off profitable magazine titles like Top Gear. Thompson said he plans to reinvest the money in high-quality content. It's always high-quality content, isn't it? It's never terrible content. To the tune of around £600 million a year. Maggie Brown, this is... it was interesting that it was leaked to the Times almost in its entirety. What do you make of the big-picture strategy?
Well, the big-picture strategy is not really as presented by the BBC. I mean, they're making minute cuts, really, to their output. I mean, there may be very vociferous complaints from the Six Music lobby, not many from the Asian Network lobby, you notice. And clearly, there's upset within the BBC and uncertainty because they are facing perhaps 6-9 months of consultation. But set that aside, what's actually happening is that all of the main services from BBC One onwards are not just protected, but are going to benefit from what may be a wall of money coming in to add to their programme budgets. So this isn't a BBC in retreat, or even, I would say, desperately changing its feathers. It's actually a BBC strong, confident. I think the Financial Times actually called it a defiant BBC.
Let's get to some of the particular... Well, I'll come back to that in a minute. Let's just deal with Six Music, though. Paul Robinson, music radio is your background, of course. It's funny how Six Music wasn't exactly a high-profile station beforehand, but now it seems that everyone is a fan.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, the BBC Trust criticised it for that very reason, not being high enough profile. Only 80% of the population had never heard of it. And now suddenly everyone's talking about it. I mean, obviously, the money saved from Six Music is minuscule. I mean, £6.5 million content budget, probably £10 million when you roll in a bit of studios and saving on DAB transmission. It's a drop in the ocean, as Maggie says.
Do you get the sense, Maggie, that it will be, due to popular demand, saved for the nation by the trust, and actually this is just part of the plan to make it look as if the BBC is doing something rather than actually doing anything.
Well, I think the BBC is engaged in high politics, but set that on one side. I think that what will happen is that there will be now a period of... There's a three-month consultation which takes the BBC beyond the election. The Trust is perfectly able to come back and say, and I know that they have had more complaints than they expected. The reaction is greater than the BBC anticipated. And the Trust can come back and say, well, actually, we're going to save it after all. But the basic point is, I think, that the BBC is also playing a political game because Six Music is a very small digital station. Okay, only 20% had heard of it. Now everybody has, but it's still a digital station. It's not like they're proposing to close down Radio 2 or one of the really big stations. So if you're a Conservative politician thinking of coming into government, or indeed if you're Ben Bradshaw saying, well, you know, the BBC perhaps is too big, the response of the public is, wait a minute, we actually like these services. Almost anything that they touch from now onwards, there will be a huge complaint about. So, in a sense, the BBC has judged this quite carefully.
But I can't.
Nothing
I can't
is going
imagine,
to be under attack.
I can't imagine. Can you really imagine, Paul, a massive campaign got up on the internet to save BBC Three television?
No, not at all. I think that's why it's very interesting. They've gone for the two radio stations. They are digital stations, as Maggie says. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think people outside the BBC are questioning the size and scope of the BBC overall. And these really are very small gestures. Mm. You know, really, what should have been said is let's axe Radio 2, or let's decide we're not going to do that anymore because it's not distinctive enough. Yeah, let's axe the television station. This is really tinkering around the edges.
Well, either the BBC accepts the criticism that it is too big, or it doesn't.
It doesn't accept it. No, this is saying, this is exactly that point. It's saying it doesn't accept that, and all it's doing is moving money around. I mean, it's still got £3.5 billion pounds.
This is the thing that really annoys me, because it's not cuts. Well, you know, when people talk about BBC cuts, the BBC isn't cutting, because the entire licence fee settlement is settled, and it still has the same amount of money.
There's two things here that are going on. The public has spoken, or some of them, over Six Music, but secondly, the commercial lobby, who have been attacking the BBC remorselessly over the past decade, have in a way been isolated because they've been shown to be playing to their own commercial interests. And the kind of things they want the BBC to cut back from, some of them actually are not going to happen. You can see that because the public would protest. But if you park that to one side, I know this because I've just been at the BBC. The point of the cutbacks now is that money remains within National Radio, and other investments will be made. Maybe there'll be a Radio 4 extra channel. Well, so there's not going to be less money or anything like a reduction in output.
And the other point is that from the commercial broadcaster's point of view, this has created no opportunity. You know, it's not as though they've closed things which actually don't really satisfy the market failure argument. Actually, Six Music and Nation Network are not going to be provided by the commercial sector. So there's no cheer for the commercial sector. What they really want to see is Radio 2. And there's a little hint to it. You know, Radio 2 becoming less commercial. You know, Chris Evans not being like a commercial breakfast show without adverts. Yeah. And Radio 1 not actually encroaching on Galaxy and the other stations.
One aspect of this, of course, is that the BBC is meant, one of the things it's charged with doing is driving take-up of digital radio, but they're closing two digital radio stations.
Well, I think this is generally bad news for digital radio and DAB. You've got with the Asian Network and Six Music, and I'm assuming the audiences don't overlap too much, you've got about 1 million people there who were listening to digital radio having their services taken away. Now, if you're going to convert from analogue to digital, you've got to offer more stuff on digital than on analogue, and suddenly two big services which aren't on analogue have been taken away, and that can't help take up of DAB. It must be bad news for DAB.
It's quite clear then, Maggie, that there is still going to be a political and ideological battle over the scale and scope of the BBC, as Paul put it, when the next licence fee settlement comes round. Because as we've established in this discussion, it's all about the size of the licence fee settlement and the income that the BBC gets. That's what determines the scale and size of the BBC. And there will be a new government, presumably, when that happens.
Well, I found myself surprised as I listened to the presentation, and I've read the paper twice, because in the bits that analyse how the BBC is regarded by the audiences, there's lots and lots of footnotes and there's great care taken. But when you come to the bits about what they intend to do next and how this extra £600 million of whatever we call it, money, assets, or the reprioritisation of funding is going to be flowing, what you find is a great deal of vagueness. And if I was in the commercial sector, facing a BBC where, after all, the majority of radio listening is going to it, it's got the strongest terrestrial television channels. And this is what Archie Norman at ITV picked up on yesterday. You have a BBC pushing yet more money into services and networks that are already doing incredibly well.
The other thing is, I think the BBC has not properly got across this idea it's going to try and be more efficient. You know, it's been criticised in the past over executive pay, you know, Mark Thompson's salary downwards as being large for, you know, what he does. And they're talking sort of around the periphery about being more efficient and spending more money on screen and on services and less on administration. But they haven't got that point across at all. And I think had they done more to communicate, they were going to try and cut out waste and put more money into broadcasting. I think that'd be a good thing. It's been lost.
They simply have so much money.
And the Tories have said
the reason they can say there's £600 million of whatever you want to call it going around or there to be reallocated is that they've been spending so much on buildings and infrastructure.
Well, which was criticised by the National Audit Office this week. This disastrous, you know,
and helicopters flying over and taking pictures and ridiculous things.
But my point is that when that comes to an end in 2 years' time.
Yes, this is the broadcasting house redevelopment.
Yes, and also Salford, and you know. Bits and pieces in Cardiff and everything else. Yes. So my question is, and you have to ask this question, this is why I actually suddenly thought, my God, the BBC is actually overfunded, because if it's not spending that on property and that money is supposed to now slosh back into existing services, well, poor old ITV, old Channel 4.
Anyone who can find £600 million relatively easily must have a fair number of jacuzzis of cash.
Yes. They're on the third floor of Broadcasting House. We established this last
week. They've moved to Ferry Road.
Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, the Media Guardian team have been working overtime on this all week, and you can read all of their comment and analysis at mediaguardian.co.uk. Now then, let's put the BBC to one side for a moment, because there are and have been, of course, a few other stories making the headlines this week. Maggie, let's start with you. Our old friend Stephen Carter. Don't we love Stephen Carter? He has got a new job.
Yes, I spoke to him on the phone yesterday. He's going to be the Director of Communications Strategy and, goodness knows, Marketing.
Global marketing.
At Alcatel-Lucent, which is a Paris-based, large multi...
Maker of hopeless mobile phones, I seem to remember.
Well, I haven't tried them out recently. Yeah. But anyway, he's got a new job. But the interesting thing is that not only is it based in Paris, not, of course, in the UK, where he perhaps isn't the most popular person having got out of government, but he's actually going to be working for Ben Verwaayen, who is the former chief executive of BT, who, of course, went...
His old nemesis.
Old nemesis, you could say, because, of course, when Carter was founding chief executive of Ofcom, one of his biggest kind of coups, you might say, was tackling BT and getting local loop unbundling sorted out so that the spread of broadband internet could be accelerated. So he hasn't, I think Stephen Carter had hoped he would be, would land a chief executive job somewhere, and I would say he hasn't quite got his expectations.
Well, we shouldn't feel too sorry for him, probably, on some massive salary that he's probably got. But a gamekeeper turned poacher, you might say.
Yes, well, or turned, I don't know, Eurostar commuter, I suppose.
Yeah, well, exactly.
It's also another example of a headhunter choosing someone who actually is not qualified for the job they're going into. You know, come from a different profession and go and run a telephone company. Fantastic.
you've been working your contacts this week, clearly, because you were on the conference call with Archie Norman, or was it a press briefing in person? I can't remember.
I was listening to Archie. This is the annual ITV, results of ITV, which came out yesterday. And Archie Norman did a very impressive turn, and for the analysts as well, as the new chairman. I mean, he sounds like executive chairman at the moment of ITV. He explained very, very clearly what the problems were at ITV. It has turned back into a small profit of £25 million, but he was quite careful not to talk up any advertising recovery at all this year, and to say that they have to nurse their advertising funded channels, ITV 1, 2, 3, 4, 3 to 5 years out, they have to find new sources of growth.
The worst is over for ITV, isn't it? Adam Crozier joins soon as chief executive. A date has been announced. Do you think there'll be a good team, Maggie? Crozier?
I just don't know. I mean, I have a lot of faith in Archie Norman as a very strategic and smart businessman. I mean, the soundings on Crozier are very mixed. The big trouble is neither of them actually knows the broadcasting business. And it is slightly bizarre to hear Norman saying that, of course, he's actually virtually adopted the same recovery plan that Michael Grade had, in that content-driven and also, increasing online revenues, which are pathetic. but would they know how to build a content business, or will they know the right people to actually have good ideas?
Well, they've got to find new revenue streams, because the fundamental problem here is that you're comparing with last year, which was terrible numbers. Yes. So, in fact, although they're up year on year, in absolute terms, they're not up. And the revenues come from a couple of programmes that have done really well, particularly X Factor and Britain's Got Talent. So the fundamental structural problems with ITV remain, and that is they've got to find new revenue streams and not be totally reliant on spot advertising.
Quite a lot of eggs, not very many baskets. Mind you, possibly, will the content-led recovery start with the rights to the Indian Premier League, we wonder, which are going to be screened on ITV4?
He's obviously been shopping in Asda for football, right, for sports rights. I don't think so. I think I made one basket that might not be too full.
Okay, very good.
Expectations are low.
Now, listen, there could be another... I'm just reading this out. This is not my joke. There could be another high-profile dyke on Fleet Street, it says here. Greg Dyke, of course, apparently is on Lebedev's shopping list for editorship of the Indie. He's going for Iconoclasts, isn't he? Rod Little. Greg Dyke would be... he would be a huge fun, but he would be a hopeless editor, surely?
I agree. I just think this is reaching fantasy levels. And what it shows us that rich individuals who wish to take over newspapers really don't have much idea about how to run newspapers. You have to hope that someone with some common sense intervenes and prevents the Indie going down.
Because all this trouble at the BBC is because of all Greg Dyke's fault, isn't it?
Of course, exactly. Greg spent all the money.
Yeah.
Well, he's good at spending money.
Yeah, well, Broadcasting House, that was his idea.
It was.
Yeah. And that's turned into a right old money pit, hasn't it? All right. You heard it here first. Read more on all these stories at mediaguardian.co.uk. Now, we'll finish up this week with a bit of politics. Party officials and broadcasting bosses have agreed the format of and the small print to the three television election debates that will be taking place over the 4 weeks of the election campaign. A mere 76 rules have been thrashed out, covering from everything from handshakes and podiums to the eye line of the moderators. But it should make for, nevertheless, a groundbreaking bit of television. Nick Robinson is the BBC's political editor, and he was one of the speakers on a panel at City University this week in a debate there about the upcoming election and the digital and internet aspects of it. He says the debates will be dramatic, but of course will have a fair dose of typical British reserve.
The exciting thing is that the leaders' debates are taking place at all. The fact that there will be, for the first time, 55 years since television became widespread, the chance to judge the guys who might be Prime Minister head-to-head, at length, discussing the issues. The thing no doubt lots of people will focus on is the fact that it's a limited debate. It's a debate, Jim, but not as we know it. That there won't be those magic moments where a member of the public skewers a politician. There won't be a moment where people in my sort of job get the chance to skewer a politician, because those are the rules that have been set.
And there are 76 rules, aren't there? That's an extraordinary amount. Have they been negotiated out of existence?
No, I think there's only one key rule that matters, which is the fact that this is essentially about a quiet discussion and debate between the leaders rather than a debate involving really active participation by the public or by the moderator. Now, some people will be sad about that. The broadcasters would no doubt have wanted a little bit more life, as they would see it, to that. But in the end, it's happening. That's what matters. It's happening. They're debating, they're discussing, and we will see something we've never seen in this country before. And if they get it right, it'll turn an election. If they don't, it'll bore the country to death. But that will be their fault. They've got the chance now.
Does this mean that this is bringing power back from television, away from the blogosphere and the Twittersphere, that it means that television will be the central defining part of this campaign?
I think television has, ever since it was invented, been the central part of election campaigns. But that doesn't exclude new media. In fact, the first reactions to a television moment will probably be on new media. They'll be on email and Twitter and the YouTube moments where they do cheeky edits of what is said. And a lot of people who don't see the debates live or get bored after 10 minutes will digest it through four or five clips, which are made to parody it or to highlight a great moment and so on. So nothing ever removes the new media, but television, well, it's quite hard to knock us down.
Nick Robinson there with at the beginning of that interview, some high heels clip-clopping in the background. They weren't his, I should add, or mine. We'll come back to Maggie and Paul in just a moment, but also speaking at that conference there at City University was DJ Collins, who's Google's Director of Communications and Public Policy in this part of the world. He told me how the debates will play out on the web.
The conversation that people have in their living rooms will now be a national living room conversation. I think people are going to dissect everything the leaders say. I think they're going to call out things that they don't think are true. I think they're going to have a conversation about who performed best, and that'll be fascinating. And I think the old media and new media, although I don't like those terms, will feed off each other. I think the debates will happen on TV, the public debate will happen online, and that will influence how the TV and newspapers report the debate, so it's going to be fascinating.
And do you think that's in a broader sense, is the way that the broader campaign will play out?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's going to be a wonderful mix of, and actually The Guardian is a very good example of how you can mix traditional print copy, but also huge user involvement on The Guardian website, and that's going to be replicated everywhere else.
What a kind man he was. It's very interesting, Maggie, that you know, this is going to be it's a bit of a moment, isn't it? Some people might say it's the Americanization of the British media and politics. But there's going to be a heck of a lot. I mean, four hours, because they're 90 minutes long each. They'll go out at 8 o'clock, probably on Thursdays, because there's football on Wednesdays during the campaign. But as Nick Robinson said, they could turn the election.
Well, they're going to be really interesting, I think, and I'm actually looking forward to them, because this is clearly an election where there's so much up for play now. The poll lead of the Tories has completely collapsed, so anything can, we feel, probably we're in hung parliament territory. So the actual attempt or ability to speak directly to wavering people is going to be such a temptation for the leaders. I'm amazed that it hasn't happened before, really, when I think about it. I mean, we've had the televising of Parliament that's worked pretty well, despite all of the sceptics. It's amazing, actually, we're in 2010 that this is happening now.
Will you be watching, Paul?
I will. I think it'll be very interesting to see who does watch, too, and whether it creates, you know, a counter-programming opportunity for the networks that haven't got it. I think, you know, what ratings these shows get are going to be really, really important, because if they get the sort of numbers that are expected, then, as you say, it's going to have a fundamental effect. It is also, of course, going to move things away from being about just policy, but it's going to be very much about performance and how well they do. You know, and you can expect certain leaders to perform better than others, although it may be the policies might be less clear than others. So I think it's going to be very interesting, you know, how those two things pan out.
You mentioned potential ratings. Nick Robinson, at that debate where we were talking about this week at City University, he was asked what would be, he thought would be a good number, and he reckoned that if they didn't get 10 million, then they would be seen as a failure. But I thought 10
well, that's
million,
a high number. That's EastEnders numbers. That's EastEnders Coronation Street. You know, that puts you in the top 10 of all programmes of the week. I mean, I think that's a tough number. I'd be surprised. I would say between 5 and 10 would be, you know, 6, 7 would be a good result.
Yeah. But the first one is on Sky News, isn't it?
They are on Sky, ITV, and the BBC is the BBC is last. I think ITV might be first, actually, but off the top of my head,
that'd
I can't
be a record
remember.
For Sky, though, wouldn't it? If you got, if you got 5 million,
no,
that'd be a record ever
no
for Sky.
Way that Sky.
Yes,
no,
that's
the,
they are clearly. I think perhaps Nick was talking, you know, about the BBC debate, but yeah, Sky is not going to get millions, is it?
But the question time. Debate with Nick Griffin, that was, I think, was it 8 million?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and that was a hugely controversial, much hyped event. A lot depends, really, on whether people expect them to be gladiatorial and really interesting, or whether they appear to be very stage managed and damp squibbish.
Well, it is extraordinary the number of points and in the agreement, 76, and the detail that they go into. For example, one of the points concerns cutaways. You're not the broadcasters. if they are they are not allowed to show cutaways of just one member of the audience. You've got to have a group of people in the shot, except if the person speaking is asking a question, or there's another exception, if the one of the members of the panel, one of the party leaders, addresses directly a member of the audience. You know, it's down to that detail.
The image I have is almost of Gulliver, you know, being pinned down by lots and lots of little Lilliputian sort of, yes. Cables or whatever we want to call it. So they're not
going out live then, they're edited.
No, they are live.
They are live. Yes. So there's all sorts of room for manoeuvre there, isn't there?
There is plenty of room for manoeuvre. Yeah. I mean, it's... And I think there's... You can pin as much down as you can. You can have as many rules as possible, but you can't legislate for as Nick was saying, those YouTube moments, can you? Something unexpected happening.
No, and there's tactics too. I mean, if you were Nick Clegg, for example, you'd absolutely try and sort of put a hand grenade into the debate, wouldn't you? Because that's going to get you more coverage than Cameron or Brown.
Well, he stands to gain massively.
Okay. I think also this thing of there's going to be an independent selection of the audience too, isn't there?
Yes. A polling company, I think it's ICM, yes. Although I stand to be corrected on that, will make a selection. The audience has got to be representative of the voting patterns of the country, and it's got to be representative of the demographic as well, and then the questions will be vetted by an independent panel. The panels are different for each. It's an editorial panel, I should say. It's not an independent panel. The broadcasters have approved the editorial panel, but then they can be then consulted with the parties. There's all sorts of still haggling that still can be done.
It strikes me that they maybe learnt from the Nick Griffin Question Time, where it looked as if the audience was very skewed towards people who live in London, and it was there were a lot of people of colour in the audience, so it would be I thought that was quite a key point, really.
Yes, well, we've put we'll put a link to the page that lists the 76 conditions on the Media Talk page, which is guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, and you can follow the build-up to the election on our shiny new politics homepage at guardian.co.uk/politics. Time's almost up, so perhaps we can finish with a flourish. Paul and Maggie, what have you learned this week, Paul? Any shiny, an interesting fact that you've picked up?
Oh, gosh, now you're asking. You finish with a flourish.
Yes.
Okay. Hey, it's got to be this one, hasn't it? If you wait long enough, you know, things do come round again. What was Mark Thompson's major sort of opening line? BBC will inform, educate and entertain.
Oh,
my goodness. Yes. Couldn't you come up with something a bit fresher?
Maggie?
Well, I learned something interesting. I was interrogated at this Media Summit conference and asked, do you have HD at home? So I said, yes, I do have HD at home. Why do you have HD at home? I thought, well, so that my husband can watch test match cricket and the balls, you know, moving around. And I was then asked my age, and I can happily tell you I'm in my 50s.
Yep.
And so I was then told, well, the success of HD, which is obviously enormous, is all to do with the ageing population, nothing to do with our love of technology.
Really?
And it's because all of our eyesight is deteriorating as we get older. Yes. And so everybody of a certain age is keen to get HD so that they get better pictures.
HD for the blind, it's going to be a winner, isn't it?
I was rather surprised by that. But the fact is, yes, my eyesight is not very good, and neither is my husband's. And sure, we do have HD.
My HD is really unreliable. It keeps... Oh, it does a thing.
How are your spectacles?
Yes. Perhaps to make my HD better, I should wear better glasses. Thank you very much to both of you. You'll find links to pretty much everything we've discussed on our blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, where you can post your feedback there too. We were roundly corrected very quickly for several mistakes we made last week. Thank you very much. Mediatalk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. See you next time.